On April 12, 1912, the RMS Titanic, the largest ship ever built at that time, left Southampton, England on her maiden voyage to New York City. The White Star Line that built it spared no expense in assuring her luxury. It was a legend even before she ever sailed. Her passengers were a mixture of the world's wealthiest, basking in the elegance of first-class accommodations, and then a whole lot of immigrants from throughout Europe that were packed down in the steerage. The Titanic was publicized as the safest ship ever built, so safe that she only carried 20 lifeboats, enough to accommodate about half of the 2,200 passengers and crew. Since the Titanic was built to be unsinkable, her lifeboats were thought necessary only to rescue survivors from other sinking ships that they might come by. Besides, lifeboats took up valuable deck space. But 4 days later, into her journey, 20 minutes before midnight on April 14th, the Titanic struck an iceberg. The initial responses to that was that damage was minimal, but soon it became apparent that the collision was fatal as the icy waters poured into the ship. Each passenger was issued a life jacket, but only half would find safety in a lifeboat. And the problem is, even with a life jacket, the waters were so cold, your life expectancy would only be a few minutes if you were plunged into the water that was 4 degrees below freezing. As the forward portion of the ship sank deeper and deeper, passengers scrambled to the stern. In a short time, the ship listed at a 70-degree angle, sending passengers into an icy death. The great ship slowly slid beneath the waters less than 3 hours after the collision. Now, the next morning, the liner Carpathia was able to rescue 705 survivors out of 2,200. 1,522 passengers and crew were lost. The reason that I mention this is something that happened right before the Titanic set sail. One of the passengers, a Mrs. Albert Caldwell, asked a crewman if the ship really was unsinkable. And the crewman responded, "God himself could not sink this ship." Now, as we turn to the book of Obadiah this evening, you see that a similar attitude prevailed in that nation of Edom. And they had a lot of pride and arrogance. They believed that God himself could not bring them down. They were deceived by their own pride. And Obadiah tells them, in effect, "You've got another thing coming." You see, the book of Obadiah is a divine revelation about divine judgment. And it's a message that needs to be heard today. I agree with Chuck Swindoll when he said, "I fear that in our hurried pace, we come to Obadiah, and without going to the trouble to examine the background, it falls on deaf ears. We shrug our shoulders and say, it's just another one of those strange minor prophets. No wonder they're minor. And we go on to Jonah, because we know that story. But there's nothing minor about this message. As a matter of fact, it is potent. It is even severe. It is delivered to a people who were proud." Now, if you've turned to Obadiah, take a look at verses 3 and 4. "The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rocks and make your home on the heights, you who say to yourself, 'Who can bring me down to the ground?' Though you soar like the eagle and make your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord." Now move down to verses 8 and 9. "In that day, declares the Lord, will I not destroy the wise men of Edom, men of understanding in the mountains of Esau? Your warriors, O Teman, will be terrified, and everyone in Esau's mountains will be cut down in the slaughter." You see, the Edomites thought that they were invincible. And in this book of Obadiah, Edom supplies a striking physical illustration of a spiritual principle that's repeated time and time in the Old and in the New Testaments. It goes like this. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, but whoever humbles himself will be exalted. The prideful person says, who can bring me to the ground? Nobody can touch me. Nobody can stand in my way. My plans are laid out, and I will carry out everything I set out to do. This self-sufficiency and this feeling of personal invulnerability, it's a mark of pride. And as John Stott puts it so well, nothing is so nauseating to God that the stench of human pride. Now, last week, we considered the beginnings of Edom as a nation, descendants as they were from Esau, the older brother of Jacob. We noticed that Edom was a mountainous nation southeast of the Dead Sea. During the reigns of kings Saul, David, and Solomon, Edom chafed under Israelite rule. They were finally able to throw that off around 750 BC. And for the next century and a half or so, Edom flourished economically. They enjoyed the high point of their own political power. During that time, the northern nation of Israel was defeated and subjected by the Assyrians. Then later, the southern nation of Judah was destroyed by the Babylonians. But while this was going on, Edom, by means of some shrewd diplomacy and some cautious political policies, they managed to avoid getting caught up in all of this. They were pretty well left alone. And so they felt that they were better. They looked down their noses on their neighbors. With this as a backdrop, we can see how Edom could be infected as a nation with pride. Now, it's true that a healthy sense of national pride can exist, but Edom crossed the line. They went from national pride to arrogance. And their pride was manifested in that they trusted their wisdom, they trusted their warriors, and they trusted their wealth. They believed that they were the best and the brightest, not needing God, not needing anybody else. And you know, in a nation that once proclaimed in God we trust, yet seemingly needs Him less every day, I think this is a timely message. The Edomites trusted their wisdom. See, back in the ancient world, Edom was best known for her wisdom. This dates all the way back to the book of Job, whose principal character lived in Uz. Now, if you read in Lamentations 4, and most Christians don't, if you read there, you'll find that Uz was a city of Edom. Remember Job's friend, I use that term loosely, Eliphaz? He was from Teman, the same town that is mentioned here in Obadiah. These were towns of Edom. The principal characters of Job were from this land. And what were they known for? At that time, they were considered the best and the brightest. Their wisdom was legendary. The names Uz and Teman were to that world what Oxford and Cambridge are to England, or what Harvard and Yale are to us. It was the height of academia. That's where wisdom was. And if you wanted wisdom, that's where you went. Now we might wonder, where did that come from? How did they get so well known for wisdom? Remember that Edom is a crossroads. Edom was partway between Egypt and Babylon or Assyria. And oftentimes the caravans, the trade routes, would go right through Edom. Their main road was called the King's Highway. And so you would get people from literally all over the world coming. And they would stop there in Edom. And they would share the stories of their homeland. They would share their wisdom. And so Edom just started accumulating all of these ideas and philosophies, all of these thoughts from different parts of the world, and incorporated them into their own sense of wisdom. They had no interest, however, in building wisdom based on the revelation of God Himself. Their worldly wisdom ruled out any need for God. So in this way, their wisdom was actually foolishness. As we saw last week, the Edomites were known for not worshiping any god at all. And there's twice in the book of Psalms we read the same words, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. You see that in Psalm 14:1. You see it also in Psalm 53, verse 1. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 1:27, God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. Wise in their own eyes, that is. G. Campbell Morgan's a classic preacher of a century ago. He said of the Edomites, they were the very embodiment of that practical, defiant godlessness, expressing itself in the deification of self and that conviction that self was sufficient and that the fortresses which it had made for its own protection were enough to protect it from against all opposition. You see, true atheism rarely exists. When one rejects the true God and does not replace him with another idol, man usually makes himself God. Morgan said that as the deification of self. Man becomes their own God. I don't need God. I don't need anybody else. I can do it myself. They've bought into the lie of Satan all the way back at the Garden of Eden. You will be like God. And they've bought into that. They believe that in themselves. And you know, we hear that a lot today in our culture. We hear a lot about rugged individualism. You got to make it on your own. You need no help from nobody. You got to take it on yourself. And then you hear these statements, what the mind can conceive, the mind can achieve. Anything you put your mind to, you can do it. There's only one person that can truly be said about, and that is God. But when we try to adopt it for ourselves, what are we doing? We're making ourselves God. And that is precisely what the Edomites were doing, and they called it wisdom. They were living as if God didn't exist. They may not call themselves atheists, but they were in fact practical atheists. They just lived as if there was no God. Solomon, whom we've come to know as the wisest man in the history of the world, tried to discover the true meaning of life under the sun, a phrase that meant without any reference to God. Everywhere he turned, Solomon found nothing but futility and frustration. Without God, there is no purpose to life. It's all meaningless. But the bottom line, found in the closing words of that book of Ecclesiastes, says this: fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. It all comes back to the true God. And all the wisdom of the world crashes down as foolishness if we do not let God be God. And Edom didn't learn this lesson. They trusted their wisdom, and God used their so-called wisdom to bring them down. Secondly, Edom trusted their warriors. Interestingly enough, though the Edomites boasted of military might, history records no great battles that they ever won. They never beat anybody on the battlefield. They were like the great team that looks really good on paper, but they never make it out onto the field. They never defeated anybody. Their only military strength was defensive. They could keep invading armies out. But we see no time where the Edomites took the offensive, went out to fight another army, and won. Yet they trusted their warriors. They trusted their military might. Now their pride here was grounded in the geographic location on the heights, from which they drew their sense of security and self-sufficiency. Something you'll notice about the book of Obadiah: it makes a lot of use of the geography of the area. Remember, we were talking about the importance of context, of putting it in its historical and geographical context. Understanding the way Edom was geographically helps us to understand Obadiah. According to the NIV Archaeological Study Bible, the region of Edom boasts numerous mountains that are anywhere from 4,000 to 5,700 feet in height. Many of the dwellings for the Edomites were cut into the faces of these high, craggy mountains. And some of those homes are still visible today. If you go to that area, it's now in the land of Jordan. But you can go there and you can see there's these mountains and people just cut into the rock. I don't know how they did it. But they made homes right in the cliffs. And then they kind of looked down and said, hey, come and get us. Because it's really hard to mount a military assault going up the side of a mountain. And so they were secure. They felt that nobody could defeat them. And you see this in verse 3. The pride of your heart has deceived you. You who live in the clefts of the rocks. You who make your home on the heights. Who say, who can bring me down to the ground? The Hebrew word there that's translated rocks, the word is selah. In Greek, that's petra. Petros means rock. Selah was the name of the city, one of the main cities there in Edom. And it became later known as Petra. And you can go and see the ruins of Petra to this day. At one time, it was considered one of the wonders of the world. It's beautiful, in a sense. It has kind of a red hue to the cliffs. And they made a magnificent dwelling in that place. And perched high on top of this natural fortress, that just fed their pride. They were just convinced that nobody could bring them down. Edom's military might then was more defensive than offensive. They relied on natural resources. They relied on political alliances with stronger nations for their security. And that turned out to be false. We're going to see in a later message who they thought were their friends turned on them. Again, going back to their so-called wisdom came around to bite them. Just like the unsinkable Titanic sunk in less than 3 hours, so the unbeatable Edomites would be laid low. Just a few years after Jesus' death, the Romans came in and they just destroyed the cities of Edom. They captured that impregnable fortress. And Edom ceased to exist as a nation. They've never risen again. Just like God said through Obadiah. So-called superpowers have risen throughout history. Egypt, Babylon, Assyria, Persia, Greece, Rome, they dominated the ancient world from time to time. France and Germany shared the world stage for a time before Great Britain emerged as a world empire. In the 20th century, you had the United States and the Soviet Union kind of vying back and forth, the arms race, the race to space, all of these things as they competed for world supremacy. Now we see Russia kind of slowly rising again, trying to dominate their part of the world. When any nation trusts in their warriors or in their military might for their security, they are in danger. As Proverbs 16:18 warns, pride goes before a destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. You see it true in Edom. You've seen it in all of these world empires. They've all come, but they've all gone. They don't last. Third, the Edomites trusted their wealth. I'd mentioned before, Edom enjoyed economic prosperity for about a century and a half before Jerusalem's fall to Babylon. But just like their military might, little of Edom's wealth came from their own work. They got most of their wealth through other people's efforts. How that worked was all of these trade routes, they were like toll roads. And when a caravan would come and they would have all of their goods that's heading for another place, the people of Edom would say, okay, you owe us for using our roads. And they taxed them very highly. And they could because it was difficult to go out and around them. That was certainly the most efficient route. So they would just pay the taxes and go on. And that was how Edom collected a lot of their wealth. Now, they did have some natural resources like copper and iron, some other minerals, but most of their wealth came from imposing tolls and taxes on the caravan trade that ran through their country. John Phillips describes their industry. The Edomites were middlemen between the Arabs and the Phoenicians. Holding a sword over the harbors of the Gulf of Aqaba, the masters of Edom levied tribute on the Tarshish, which is modern-day Spain, ships that were bearing the gold of Ophir. Sitting astride the roads that ran from Damascus to Memphis, and I'm not thinking that's Memphis, Tennessee, Edom's customs agents halted merchant caravans from Arabia, Persia, the distant East, Egypt, Tyre, far-off Greece. Either the traders paid taxes or they forfeited everything. Thus, the Edomites filled their caves with the wealth of both the East and the West. But in this book of Obadiah, Obadiah says that their wealth is going to be plundered to the point that nothing would be left, similar to Jerusalem's condition after the Babylonians were done destroying it. Look at verses 5 and 6 there in Obadiah. If thieves came to you, if robbers in the night, oh, what disaster awaits you. Would they not steal only as much as they wanted? If grape pickers came to you, would they not leave a few grapes? But how Esau will be ransacked, his hidden treasures pillaged. See, their wealth would be no more. Unlike ordinary thieves, their plunderers would take everything they could find. And unlike the grape harvesters, which would leave a few behind, there wouldn't be anything left. This would be the end of Edom and its boasted wealth. You know, trusting in wealth is literally fool's gold. The Bible warns time and time again against the transitory nature of material wealth. You know, we saw last week in that parable Jesus told of the rich farmer. He had a bumper crop, and he said, oh, this is great. I'm going to build new barns and silos. I'm going to kick back and take it easy. I've got it made for the rest of my days. And what did God say to him? You fool. This very night your life will be required of you, and then who's going to get it all? You see, the lifetime of gathering is reduced to nothing at the moment of death. And remember, you'll never see a hearse pulling a U-Haul. Not going to happen. You can't take it with you. So it's no wonder that Paul writes in 1 Timothy 6, beginning in verse 6, but godliness with contentment is great gain. We brought nothing into this world. We can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we'll be content with that. People who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierce themselves with many griefs. Then down to verse 17. Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant. See, that was the problem of Edom. They were wealthy, but they were arrogant. Nor to put their hope in wealth. Again, that's what Edom did, which is so uncertain. But to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age so that they may take hold of life that is truly life. See, Edom boasted of the best and the brightest, but God brought them down to the ground. They trusted in their wisdom. They trusted in their warriors. They trusted in their wealth. Yet in the end, none of them could save them from the hand of God. If Obadiah's prophecy tells us anything, it's that those who are proud will fall, those who exalt themselves will be humbled by God, those who trust in their own strength and might will eventually come crashing down. Now, I don't think we have to stretch our imaginations too far to see an application here. We can all think of contemporary Edomites where deification of self leads to pride. We call them Americans. Arrogance rules their lives. They are materialists whose security is in human wisdom, power, or wealth. These are the practical atheists who simply live as if God does not exist. Accountable to no one but themselves, they worship at the shrine of humanism. There are no rules except the rules they set, and they usually set them to control others. People are manipulated as things. Accumulated accomplishments of success are touted as the true meaning of life. These are the truly dangerous people. These are the real enemies of God. We must all be aware, however, of the subtle sin of pride in our own lives. As long as life is going well, we are tempted to trust in ourselves instead of in God. Pride always comes before a fall. If we insist on our own greatness, we will have to be cut down to size because we were created to be dependent on our Creator. If we think we've got it all together, we could not be more wrong. And the sooner we learn that, the better. That's why God says, if you will humble yourself, I will exalt you, but if you exalt yourself, I will humble you. I think a fitting conclusion to this message comes from Obadiah's contemporary, Jeremiah, who wrote in Jeremiah 9, verses 23 and 24, this is what the Lord says, "Let not the wise man boast of his wisdom, or the strong man boast of his strength, or the rich man boast of his riches. But let him who boasts boast about this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who exercises kindness, justice, and righteousness on earth, for in these I delight, declares the Lord." May we all take this lesson to heart. I'd like you to turn in your hymnals to hymn 413. I'll admit, this is more often a invitation or a communion hymn than an invitation hymn. But I think it's very appropriate in this particular message, especially the last line. "When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss, and pour contempt on all my pride." We have a lot that we can be proud of in this country. We have it better than most of the people in the world. And it's easy to deceive ourselves into thinking, I've got it all together. We need to be brought back to the cross. We need to be humbled. We need to say ourselves, Lord, I have nothing. Anything I have, you have given to me. And anything that you've given to me, you can take away. You've got that right. I'm just glad to be your child.